Just what America needs in an election year. In honor of Alex Garland's Civil War, out this weekend, where California and Texas have allied as the Western forces, declare your state for or against them.
I am Katie Rich, and as the only person on this podcast living in a state that once did secede from the Union, I feel pretty confident that North Carolina and many of the rest of the former Confederate states would do their own thing.
Are you bragging that you live in a state?
I'm just saying they have a proven track record, and there's no reason to expect them to do it differently this time.
I am Matt Patches, currently in New Jersey. We'd probably be having our own internal civil war while I... state or nationwide civil war happens just because we're purple. So I'm just going to say we're going to sit it out, but like have our own problems.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven. I haven't seen the movie, but so many Colorado transplants are from California and Texas. Yeah, we'd probably get sucked into the Western forces. However, my girlfriend Java says we have all the water and wouldn't have to ally with anybody.
I'm David Ehrlich, and I live in New York City, which often feels like a country unto itself to begin with. You go into a very different territory when you go even like 40 minutes north on the train or the car, certainly up to the Hudson Valley. But I don't know. I feel like I'm, you know, New York's going to do what New York's going to do. And
you're going to blow the bridges and you'll be OK.
I think as we see in the first scenes of Civil War, yeah, that's kind of a Dark Knight Rises scenario the Patch is imagining. We need the Batman to save us. But in the Civil War, things seem kind of business as usual in New York City in the beginning of the movie, except there's a suicide bombing in Brooklyn, a Brooklyn that looks absolutely nothing like part of Brooklyn because it's clearly Atlanta. And it's supposed to be like, imagine there was a suicide bombing in Brooklyn. The hipsters blowing themselves up. Can you imagine?
I thought it was a croissant witch or whatever the fuck.
A cronut.
The bomb is actually made out of avocado toast. It's avocado toast dipped in nitroglycerin.
This is why he made this film, because we're laughing at the circumstances, but we can't imagine a war at home. Get fucking triggered and rattled.
This is why I'm too stressed to even contemplate seeing the movie Civil War.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 470. It is the week of Wednesday, April 10th. That is the day that in 1633, the first bananas went on sale in London from a guy named Thomas Johnson. That's a great I love that we know the date. I don't know why.
Oh, because there's an ad. On this day.com or whatever, on this, there's like a little ad that's like, April 10th, yes, we have bananas. It has pictures of bananas, because how the fuck were the people of London supposed to know? But it is black and white because, you know, color printing, not a thing in 1633.
Yeah. I mean, if you'd asked me when I thought that England first had bananas, I probably would have said later than 1633. So congratulations, colonialism, which I'm guessing is why that's possible.
What a fun fact to have on today's show. Just banana facts.
Yeah, no problems went into this whatsoever. We are all here back together. David is freed of his in-laws. Once more, we assume.
In-laws?
No, like your in-laws are no longer staying in your house, as far as we know.
That's true.
But I think we're still chock full of emails for this week again. And what, Dave, you decide we're just going to go through them all? Was that the plan?
We have one app review if we want to kick that off. And then, yeah, I'm hoping to speed through some emails.
All right, let's hear that app review.
Oh, I guess I'm also doing that. Oh. Here we go.
Oh, wait, whoa.
Don't skip David and his one thing.
I gave him three seconds of air.
The only time in this podcast where I feel like I contribute something capably, and it's reading these reviews, like the one from JackMove69, who says, amazing pod. Love these folks and look forward to every episode. I follow Dave around through many different shows and can't get enough of him. See, Dave, you would have had to read that about yourself. Can you imagine? Glad to hear Dave is healing up. Bummed to hear Katie's VF news. But VF has been falling off for a while, so I'm sure Katie will move on to better things.
Wait, is that in the letter, or are you saying that?
It
is.
I was there for that, though. Like, I appreciate the sentiment, but part of that's me.
Vanity Fair sucked for a minimum 10 years.
If Vanity Fair suddenly improves in quality,
then we can have a discussion. Yeah.
Well, let's kick off some emails. Here we go. This first one, the subject is Germany needs more Katie. Dear War Room, sorry to advance my grammar and or spelling. I'm a listener from Germany. I'm not sure how good my English is. You figure it out. I was very late to your party and found you like a year ago thanks to falling in love with Katie's voice on the Little Gold Man podcast. Since then, I have only skipped a handful of episodes and did some catching up on old episodes with topics I might be interested in. Long story short, since nobody cares for things I write on X or Instagram, I want to use this medium to make sure Katie knows how heartbroken I am about the news to not be able to listen to her on the Little Gold Men podcast. I know I will still be able to listen to her on this podcast, but love to see / hear the full spectrum of her opinions. Please keep us updated about the next steps and possibilities to listen to her. Maybe Katie could become a regular on the This Had Oscar Buzz a long time, as long as there is nothing else on the horizon. I'm sorry, but I need my weekly dose of Katie Rich twice. And as much as I love fighting in the war room, this is not enough for me. Sorry for being that selfish. I hope everyone is doing fine and doing well. Many greetings from Germany, Stefan. You know what? That's some great English, Stefan.
Excellent
you
English.
Did just great.
Yeah, I would say Katie, that. Excellent news for your future in the event that something happens to your marriage. I feel like
I know, Stefan
you've
and
got
I,
fallback plans up the wazoo connection. Out there.
I do feel like I am like spiritually usually a guest on This Hot Oscar Buzz, even if I'm not on it, because my texts with Joe and Chris get referenced in most episodes I listen to. So there's that for now. Perhaps in the future, who knows?
This next email subject is Anatomy of a Fall. Hi, Fitwer. Dave, I'm so glad you're on the mend. Just wanted to let you know you're not crazy for considering attending your Ghostbusters screening. On Oscar nominations morning, I fell and dislocated my shoulder while walking to work. My husband's first two comments to me were, "You fell down 2024, and let's call this Anatomy of a Fall." As I continued my trek to work, because I couldn't physically drive myself anywhere, I had to wait for my husband to pick me up. I continued to listen to the Oscar nominations because priorities. So I guess pop culture is important and makes us feel good. And Katie, you will be terribly missed on Little Gold Men, Julie.
They should call the story of the last few months at Vanity Fair Anatomy of a Fall.
I feel like that's exactly what I would do if I were injured. Like Oscar nominations, the wait for no man. And maybe it's a useful distraction from pain. Maybe.
This next email subject is Steenburgen to Blunt in 2. Hello from Chicago. Long time / first time, yada, yada, yada. I know this has been a few weeks now, but it's been gnawing at me and I just have to share. Mary Steenburgen was in Happiest Season with the great Victor Garber, who was in Sicario with Emily Blunt.
Hey.
Love the show. Hoping for more Maestro and Dune talk. Just kidding.
That is not on the horizon.
I think someone tweeted this at us also with a different solution for it.
Man, there have been two uses of the word horizon in the last minute. I feel like, what is Kevin Costner paying you for
you're
subliminal
preparing
advertisements that are already
preparing for Cannes this year?
Oh my God. There could be four horizons on the horizon if we're not careful.
Oh, boo. I mean, I'll see one, but then
I watched the first hour
of
Dances with Wolves for the first time last night. So.
Wow.
Shit's getting real.
Scene of him, of the leg amputation surgery at
the
Civil War Hospital is vividly, I saw that when I was like roughly when the movie came out, way too young. It is burned in my brain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The subject of this next one is Piracy and Dave. Hi, Fitwer crew. I usually hate hearing criticism from your listeners on your show, but I'm now forced to give some of my own. Apologies up front, as I think everyone on the podcast is great. I love everyone's insight and opinions, but I felt compelled to write this email when Dave spoke about how he watched Godzilla X Kong and Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. First, I want to state that I have not been beyond piracy myself. As a broke film college student, I frequently downloaded everything and anything I could get my hands on to increase my knowledge of the medium. Maybe it was guilt from my years of illegal downloads, or maybe I didn't want to be stealing from the industry I was now in, but whatever the case was, once I was able to sustain myself financially, I began paying for any of the media I consumed. So to hear Dave pirated two films made me disheartened. I am absolutely empathetic to the fact he's unable to attend screenings right now, and I was happy to hear he bought a ticket to Godzilla X Kong as a way to pay for his pirating, but choosing not to pay for Ghostbusters because he didn't like it left a real sour taste in my mouth. I don't want to come across as some corporate shill who is out here boohooing because some mega conglomerate didn't get Dave 16 bucks or whatever, but I think someone like him who is already in the privileged position of getting to go to free screening should not be gleefully announcing that he didn't give money to a movie he didn't like. Dave himself may even say that his money doesn't mean anything in the grand scheme of the box office, but I find that thinking akin to people saying their one vote doesn't mean anything, which is, we'll talk about that maybe later. Honestly, I might not have been so mad if Dave had chosen to pay for neither of them rather than just one. Real people worked on both. Why don't they both deserve the value of his purchase? This fact is compounded when the crew discussed how poorly Ghostbusters was doing at the box office. For the record, I thought Frozen Empire was poor as well, and if given the chance, I would have waited for it to go to streaming. But going to the cinema is a roll of the dice. If we only gave money to the things we liked, we wouldn't have media that challenges us, that makes us uncomfortable, that makes us angry. For a show that often laments the decline of such movies, I wish the hosts were more reflective of not just what they consume, but how they are consuming it and how they are supporting it. Sure, Ghostbusters may not be some art house film that is struggling for eyes to see it, but it feels like a double standard is being set. Sorry for the long ranting email, and I honestly don't know why it stuck in my craw so much. In general, I am much more ambivalent when it comes to piracy. I understand it as sometimes a necessity for people because of the cost or because of the access, but Dave would have waited till he was healthy enough, I hoped, and they were still in theaters. If they weren't, they certainly would have been on PVOD soon after. Anyway, 5 stars, George. George.
Signed, Slimer.
So I was going to say, signed, Muncher. Muncher is looking for royalties.
I don't know anything about Muncher.
I don't think I've seen any of the new Ghostbusters
by legal means or otherwise.
Movies are
I've only seen the newest one, and Muncher's not in it. I forgot all about him.
Pretty sad for Muncher.
Thanks to the dual strikes of last year, everybody that worked on Ghostbusters Frozen Empire definitely got paid before the movie came out. So I didn't steal from anybody but Sony, and Sony could bring it up with me if they want. Did I set a double standard? Absolutely. Would I do this with an independent film? Never. But you know what? Fuck the Ghost Corps. Sorry, George. That's my opinion.
Dave's opinions are not necessarily reflective of everyone on this podcast.
That's true.
Absolutely. No. I'm definitely just speaking for myself. And,
I can't think of another instance where you've ever done this for... Well, I guess I don't really know. Do I even know you anymore?
Do I even know... I mean, here's the other thing about piracy. I have a drive that's all of the Star Wars that I could get my hands on in chronological order. Why? Because A, that's something they still don't actually offer with like the animated Clone Wars series. And B, with the advent of so many things moving to streaming, if I don't buy it, it could disappear. If I don't pirate it, it could disappear. That's been happening to movies recently. So I definitely was like George, where definitely somebody who's in the industry and who started making enough money to pay for things. I usually pay for things, but I'm never going to say don't pirate something because
the disappearing argument, though, I tend to find that piracy is often the one place you can find movies after they're disappeared from their streaming platform.
Yeah, like, but what about when that goes away and the society collapses and Dave's hard drive is the Book of Eli
and Civil War.
That's right. Or even if you buy something like, say, through Apple or through Amazon, it's still kept on their library. So if you read the fine print, they're allowed to take that away from you at any given time. So piracy, to a certain extent, is the only type of film preservation we're going to have, especially if things are released on disc. So, you know, it's a complicated thing, and I'm certainly not feeling bad for anybody that worked on Ghostbusters Frozen Empire and got paid to do so.
I feel bad for everybody who worked on Ghostbusters Frozen Empire personally, but...
No, as somebody who's been working in reality TV for this long, a paycheck is a paycheck. I don't begrudge anybody for that. The subject of the sex email is a 5-star review with pros and a caution. I've reviewed the podcast app before, but never motivated to leave any pros. And never mind.
This is off
the start. Next thing said, don't read this on the air. So cool. Good to know. I will pass these things on to my other listeners, and that means we might actually get to finish all the emails because there's only one left. Here we
Woo!
Go. Subject is not a review, a humble request. I would like to start this by thanking Dave and Katie for pointing out sizism in cultural things in the most recent podcast. Katie, I'd like to particularly thank you for the way you spoke about the egregiousness of the whale on Fitwear last year. However, Patches, my guy, your fat miasma, I can't pronounce that word.
He's kind of a
Mazda. Thank you. is kind of a big fucking bummer. I could point out to you the work of Professor Sabrina Strings, a sociologist who has linked fat phobia to white supremacy. I could point you to the work of Aubrey Gordon, who has two great books about the fat experience, debunking societal myths about fatness. I could point to articles about pay discrepancy, articles that prove the diet industrial complex makes $72 a year, and yet only 5% of diets work. I could point you towards peer-reviewed papers that show adipose tissue is less harmful to one's health than inherent biases by practitioners, or that the recent Ozempic craze has created a shortage of the medication for folks who need it medically, essentially creating a system of eugenics where we prioritized already privileged people's desire for societal aesthetics over other medical needs. I'm sorry I didn't pre-read that paragraph to make sure I could pronounce all the words. but the only thing I will do is ask that you extend enough humanity towards fat folks that I don't have to steel myself for casual cruelty towards people who look like me when pressing play on a podcast. The world is cruel. Listening to folks who clearly know one another well talk about media as a balm against that. David, thank you for being so vocal about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Also, summer house of this season, chef's kiss. Dave, hell yes, Wolverine, healing powers. Katie, you are smart, affable, and incredibly good at the work you do, and I hope you find a place to land that appreciates you the way you deserve. Patches, as somebody who did children's theater for the better part of a decade, I truly can't tell you how much joy I got from hearing about your recent theater foray. Be well, Jesse Oliver, unapologetically fat.
What did you say?
I wish I knew what I said. Does anyone remember? I wish that had
maybe
been cited
is it the
here.
Whale? Did we?
But this is a reference to things that have happened in the last few weeks. So I actually have no idea. So. And I apologize more for not knowing what this letter is about. But, you know, I don't think I have any prejudice against that.
I don't think you're a secret white supremacist, Patches. I don't think you're on the slide.
As people who were all raised in American culture, particularly diet culture of the 90s in which we were all bathed, I think everyone comes into life now with some kind of fat phobia, whether or not we're aware of it, and often it's internalized. So it is very easy to slip into language that is hurtful to people without realizing that we're doing it or without having any conscious biases, which I think I've certainly done too.
Almost everything. Too, yeah, and think about that a lot, and I don't have too much specific. I have no defense to this letter, other than I'm always trying to watch myself in that way and meet people where they are, and I really don't have any strong feelings about body image and how people present themselves and how people live. So live on and be well. I really don't know what we said.
Yeah. I would second the recommendation for Aubrey Gordon's work too. Good podcast, good work. I haven't seen the movie about her, but I've learned a lot.
Yeah, and you know, Patches, I want you to know this is a safe space, and if
is a safe space.
I mean, talking to us is a safe space, and I've definitely I woke up on Sunday with a fever and got in a Twitter argument. And accidentally responded to something about AI and disabled people by just being people without any hands can draw. And you know, sometimes when you're trying to win an argument, you say some really stupid things. And what Katie said is correct. We are all, you know, trying our best, but some certain things are baked in. And
what I
appreciate
about
important.
This letter is that I think they are operating in good faith to say that they're doing
agree.
Thing. They don't
that
think
way.
That I'm like,
doesn't
a total
that make all
asshole.
The difference? Doesn't that make all the difference?
Absolutely.
It really does.
In this day and age, I hope that we can air these grievances and work in good faith to know that people who may say the wrong thing at the wrong time are not total assholes through and through. So
I think you get a lot more of that when it comes to people responding in writing to a podcast than especially a podcast that's going to read what they write on air than you might on other forms of media.
That's why you do a podcast for 13 years. There's so much evidence of what you really feel that someone's going to give you the benefit of the doubt. There's something to that.
Yeah. You know, then right at the, it's like, we'll go really hard on Patches at the beginning and then also end with a little kiss on the cheek. That's a great way of doing some criticism.
Also, I would never talk about my feelings about eugenics on this podcast. You can go to my Daily Wire.
Those are just loaded. Yeah.
That's for eugenics chat with Matt Patches.
We're thriving. The Patreons is blowing up. Yeah, tough times, but Civil War's coming out too. We're getting sponsorships. It's great.
Please leave us emails on the Apple Podcast or reviews on the Apple Podcast app so the algorithm could push us to more people. But also, if you want to email us, like apparently a lot of you do, you can email us at fitwr.podcast@gmail.com. On with the show.
It's the dream.
Ripley. Sure.
Let it rip.
I am very tired tonight, which I feel like fits the general pallor of Steven Zalian's new Ripley series. Steven Zalian, that is a name that I don't feel like comes up a lot these days. I mean, I will always think of him.
Some of us watched Schindler's List last week.
I will always think of him as the person who wrote Schindler's List, what I was going to say. And second to that, you know, the person who directed Searching for Bobby Fischer, a movie almost as important to my cultural identity.
Have we ever talked about that on the podcast? Why is that so important to you? I love that movie. And when I was in film school, I was like, I want my movie to look like this. Searching for Bobby Fischer, which is a strange touchstone, maybe. But I find that film to be beautiful.
Roughly the same age as the protagonist of that movie and competed in chess tournaments as my main hobby. So
there you go. I guess I'm more of a Conrad Hall obsessive.
We should see it because I've never seen it, but I remember the trailer so well. Like, they play chess in the rain, and I've wondered my whole life why they would play chess in the rain.
Rachel Mendina.
Why not? Anyway, so he has adapted Patricia Highsmith's The Talented Mr. Ripley, which is a novel that was memorably adapted several times before. I mean, most famously, I suppose, in a film called The Talented Mr. Ripley, but prior to that, also in Purple Noon by Renee Clément, which starred Alain Delon. There is An American Friend, which is not...
Ripley's Game adaptation.
Yeah, it's a Ripley's Game, it's adjacent to.
And then actually the Damon movie got a sequel with John Malkovich in it, based on Ripley's Game, which I don't even know if that came in theaters or not, but that exists.
And the infamous, and I'm now reading the Wikipedia, the infamous 2003 film The Room was written by Tommy Wiseau after seeing the 1999 film adaptation based on his own interpretation of himself as a real-life Dickie Greenleaf. I did not know that either. And it says it on Wikipedia, so it must be true. But I think if it's interesting watching this adaptation of Ripley, because if you know the story, and certainly if you're as familiar with the Anthony Minghella version of this story as I am, it is at once very, very similar and also very, very different. It's similar in its approach to the story. I mean, there are key points in which the story deviates from any previous telling. But it also looks radically different. It was shot by Robert Elswit in black and white. And it looks better than just about anything ever has on Netflix, because it was not originally shot for Netflix and didn't, I assume, have to be submitted to their aesthetic standards, such as they are.
This is Netflix TV we're talking about. You're not saying it looks better than like Power of the Dog, like that. It looks on par with the good Netflix movies. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and like I always, you know, I never had any qualms with how The Crown looks or something like this, but this is filmic and rich and, it's certainly absent any of the telltale signs of a Netflix television production, that gloss that is sort of immediately recognizable. But it is very, very striking. And I think what I found most striking about the show is that its gait and its mood match the aesthetic really beautifully, which is supposedly inspired by the copy of the paperback version of The Talented Mr. Ripley that Steven Zalian was reading when he read it for the first time. It's a very colorful story, and it's definitely a big swing to render it in this intense, high contrast monochrome. And he adjust to that aesthetic by making Tom Ripley, who's played by Andrew Scott, who's sort of this, like, you know, down, it's described again reading the Wikipedia, down at heel, not a phrase I've ever encountered before, I think, con man, in 1960s New York. And he is, unlike Matt Damon's Ripley, he's considerably older, he's in his 40s, he's playing some nebulous age, but he looks older and shark-like rather than this like young, fresh-faced beauty. He is paid by Kenneth Lonergan, as you are, to go to Europe. And
Lonergan showing up at that shipping office is like, oh, hell yeah, we are operating on a different level than I was anticipating.
Giving like a completely deadpan performance as like a rich shipping magnate who doesn't give a fuck.
Going to be one of my top 10 like pop culture moments of the year is me yeeping and going, Kenneth Lonergan. And then looking over to my wife and being like, huh? And her going, what the fuck are you talking? Who? Why?
Alongside Bokeem Woodbine, who also pops up in that first episode and then disappears for a good long while.
Yeah.
A great
first episode. And he he goes to Europe to retrieve Kenneth Lonergan's layabout son, who makes an ungodly amount of money and trust that's been set up for him for doing nothing. And Lonergan does not have the power to end that trust. And so the best he can hope for is for Johnny Flynn, who plays Dickie Greenleaf, to be retrieved and brought back to New York to run the family business. Andrew Scott, a con man, which Kenneth Lonergan does not know, quickly decides he has a different agenda in mind when he gets to the beautiful Amalfi Coast, or wherever Dickie Greenleaf is shacked up with Marge Sherwood, who's played by Dakota Fanning. And he homoerotic overtones follow not long behind, not made as explicit as they were in the Anthony Minghella film. But and then there are murders, and then there is the vacuity of the Tom Ripley character's emptiness begins to take over as he starts to become Dickie Greenleaf, and everyone sort of knows how the story goes. But man, with a few asterisks around my feelings around the final episode, which departs from the source material and previous adaptations in some ways, and the ways in which it does that, I generally loved this series. Wow. I thought it was like a real fun bomb at the end of a long day to sort of disappear into this monochrome 1960s Italy. And bounce around with a sociopath and watch him spend an hour trying to dispose of a body in the beautiful Rome apartment that he was paying for by, forging his identity. I mean, this is put my problems into perspective. I thought Andrew Scott was fantastic. I always love seeing Johnny Flynn. He and Dakota Fanning are sort of by necessity kind of underused.
You love seeing really Johnny Flynn. What have you seen Johnny Flynn in?
What haven't I seen Johnny Flynn in?
Are you a big fan of that David Bowie movie he made?
I never saw the David Bowie movie, but
Stardust is the name of it.
I first noticed Johnny Flynn because he sang a duet with Laura Marling at the end of Goodbye First Love called The Water, which is like one of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard in my entire life. I highly encourage you to go listen to it, Dave. Maybe use it as a transition this episode. If I say it on the air, it's binding. And then he was in some Olivier Assayas projects, naturally, like Something in the Air and Clouds of Sils Maria. And then he was so good with Jesse Buckley in Beast. And I loved him in Emma, where he played George Knightley. And I loved him on Lovesick, a great show that you can watch on Netflix.
It's been made
sitcom.
For Johnny Flynn. David.
This is 100% the first time I've seen him in anything. I'm looking at his IMDb. No, I've seen Clouds of Sils Maria, but I don't remember him in it. But everything else is completely new to me. He might have been the cloud.
I can't believe you like this, David.
Wow.
I thought it really cratered quickly for me. I thought it was going to be like a chill, almost like a vacation watch. I didn't find it very gripping. But at least in the first episode, I was all in on the mood and the black and white photography I thought was interesting. And then they got to Italy and it started to look really cheap. And I wasn't like, I found it to be void of tension. And I've tapered off. I made it 4 episodes in and I'm not going to get to the end.
You got to a murder. You got to at least one murder.
Spurts of violence.
I feel like there's at least one murder that has happened pretty early in the story for the story to work. So I assume you got there.
I mean, by the time I got to the first murder, I was like, this seems early for an 8-episode miniseries that otherwise seems to be taking its time. However, I can say, Patches, I felt like you kind of struggled through 5 and 6, but now I'm like, I had to stop like 30 minutes away from the ending in the final episode, and I was surprised how much it rebounded, and in very, very tiny ways. Like, I think from the very beginning, the high contrast black and white really lends itself to like a texture and like this obsession with texture in the cinematography that I enjoyed watching even when I was bored. But then once it gets towards the end, there's like a moment where they start off the seventh episode in a place that I wasn't expecting. And they showed a curtain and I was like, oh, that curtain is that purple burgundy color that they keep harping on in the first episode.
Huh.
And it's like my mind just knew it because of the context of the entire series. There are several times in the series that they will mention the color of something and sort of like point it out to you. But obviously the series stays in black and white. And at some point it all started working for me, especially when I was laughing out loud in the final episode when John Malkovich pops up for a little bit.
Spoilers. that first murder is an excellent thing to watch. I mean, what a sequence that is. I mean, it's so, one of the advantages of making this a television show rather than a film is that you can spend 30 minutes on the nitty-gritty details of trying to dispose of the body at sea and the various calamities that ensue. As he goes about doing that, and it's just like one fuck up after another, and it's really like it's like a screwball comedy for a little while, like the most sort of dolorous screwball comedy I've ever seen, and it's a lot of fun. And I think it really speaks to something that Sam Adams at Slate wrote really eloquently and insightfully about how this Ripley, which is sort of plays into the age, not only the age of the character, but also the age in which the show is coming out, that he is not a striver, this is Sam Adams' words, but a grinder, that he is sort of, it's the precarity of his financial situation that's driving him, and he is trying to sort of get that wolf off his back. And there's something about just like always just grinding it out another shift, another day in the gig economy.
Check.
Yeah, another stolen check, right?
Yeah.
That plays into how wrong that first murder goes for him. And I think that's something Andrew Scott really latches onto over the course of this other show, and I really enjoyed about its characterization.
Well, that sense of comedy is there, and I've only watched the first two episodes, but that first episode where he's just hauling himself up and down the stairs of this idyllic Italian village, and it gets at the class aspect of it and the kind of grinding you're talking about, like how much work it is for him to appear to be like effortlessly in this social circle. And it's just funny, right? Like for it to be.
And every time you cut to that, you just see Dickie and Marge just there already at the top.
It's such a relief that, because, you know, it's in like dark high contrast black and white, like, oh, it's on Netflix, it could get like even bloodier than the movie. But it's not like a grim, dark Ripley. It's just like a richer approach to it overall, and makes time for that level of humor and that level of like psychological complexity. And I just found so much to it in the first two episodes that I watched.
Do you think this is superior to the
No, I would say I'm relieved at how different it is. I feel like it is actively asking you not to compare the two of them. I've only watched two episodes. I have a hard time imagining I'll get to the end and like put it on Mount Rushmore the way that I do the original one. But it makes it feel like there's more territory to explore that is worth eight episodes in what I've watched so far. Like you realize how many little subplots you can follow that kind of make it a richer experience than what you could get in the original movie.
I have not seen the movie. I never saw the 1999 Tales of Mr. Ripley.
How have we? God, we have to do yet another.
I just saw the English Patient for the first time like 3 weeks ago. English Patient was fine. But it definitely got me used to that director's use of like distance from a character that I could still appreciate. Which maybe Tales of Mr. Ripley is or isn't. I have read the book, because I rolled into it right after reading Strangers on a Train in college.
You're on a Highsmith high.
A little bit. So I read this one and then its direct sequel. I haven't gone all the way to Ripley's Game, or at least if I did, I don't remember it. So this one was interesting because not only was I sort of like binging it to talk about it on the podcast, but I was kept trying to compare it to the book and like different plot lines that they sort of altered or changed. Meanwhile, Java, who's a big fan of the 1999 version, and then also I learned last night, watched the like 60s French adaptation, just sort of like we were all talking about the differences between this and the other one. And Patches, I really felt like you did during like the first four episodes, like this sort of like the pace was distancing to me more than it was enveloping me into what the like plot actually was. But it really sort of picks up once I got to what David was citing is like sort of the grind, where it's like he gets to be happy at Rome for like 20 minutes and then everything goes back to the grind. And I really sort of felt for this person who is definitely has like some sociopathic behaviors, but he is much like in the book, like sort of detests murder. And every time it happens, A, not only is he not good at it, but B, it's like he's really has to be backed into a corner before murder becomes like a possibility. So I think
I've always felt, ever since reading Crime and Punishment in college, which left like such a profound impression on me, that trying to get away with murder is the most stressful thing a human being can do.
Yes.
I just like that would drive me the anxiety of just, you know, I was listening to you talk about Dave and Patches about the pacing of the show. I think part of the appeal for me was that it is sort of the prestige television equivalent of slow cinema. I mean, that there's a big gap between legitimate slow cinema and this big gap. But nevertheless, it has a sort of relaxing vibe, a pace to it that I could really sink into at the end of the day. But that is the water is troubled, literally in this case, by the anxiety of trying to cover up these murders. And like, that anxiety plays into the financial precarity that he's suffering from, becomes the defining anxiety for him, and sort of dovetails with it, and one is inextricable from the other. And like, you know, oh god, but like I have so many nightmares. The two nightmares I always have are trying to run away from people with machine guns, which I wonder where that comes from, and two, I'm trying to hide a body, which, but then trying to hide a body dream is not, it's not really a dream. I tend to think about that more when I'm awake, not because I have bodies that I want to hide, but just because I think it would be, I would be so bad at it, it would be so stressful.
Yeah, I mean, the post-murder parts of this show are definitely the most intensely stressful parts for me. The other times I kind of appreciate the distance from the character and Andrew Scott's portrayal of Ripley, because like I like watching him squirm in the moments that he has to squirm. Eventually, once like the inspector shows up.
Hi, Asa. Sorry, was I talking too loud?
Oh, I thought he was being like, don't talk about the inspector. Nobody knows how talented Mr. Ripley happened. Once the inspector shows up, once Freddie Miles shows up, like I enjoy watching my man squirm out of these things. It's not making me feel super tense like I would if I had completely become one with these characters. And Dickie and Marge are also kept at a certain distance, where I could appreciate watching the pieces sort of fall together in a way that I don't feel anxiety for anybody except when he's trying to hide a body.
I can't wait to see him hide some bodies. I made it.
Let me wrap this segment up by completely going on a tangent that Katie led me on, which was, Katie, earlier in this segment, you would say that you'd put talented Mr. Ripley on a Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, probably.
What? What
Which
else
Mount,
is on
Rushmore?
That Mount Rushmore?
I know.
Wait,
like,
what is the Mount Rushmore, and what are the three other president heads on the one where that talented Mr. Ripley is on there?
That's
I'm
a really
you
good
on the
question.
Spot. What it's is like, this Mount Rushmore like you're painting up?
It's like a 90s prestige Mount Rushmore.
Okay.
Like the, like
so let's
the,
fill this out here.
Like
for a
the
second.
Movies that like made me get like no, like that kind of like shaped my taste in that way, in some way, like I saw it at the right age to like be like, oh, this is what good movies are.
Like you're leveling up as a movie watcher. You're starting to feel like this is art, this is drama, this is
complicated. Like I tend to put Shakespeare in Love in kind of a similar boat.
Another
like 99 love that movie.
Right,
I know, I guess those are the same year,
so maybe this is a 99 Rushmore.
No, we have Damon and Ben Affleck. This is a Boston Rushmore.
Oh, so it's Rounders.
Oh, Boston Rushmore. Okay.
No, you can.
Would you put Goodwill Hunting on this Mount Rushmore?
Is no, I don't have the same. Goodwill Hunting doesn't have the same Shepherd. Kind of like extra level. I think because Goodwill Hunting is like kind of a basic story at the end of it. Like, I think it's a really good movie, but like the story of it is just not that. Like, Haunted Mr. Ripley is just like, first of all, Dave, I really really want you to watch the movie. Like, I think you will like it a lot.
I probably will now after I finish this.
American Beauty, is that on the Mount Rushmore?
No. I mean, I think American Beauty is like incredibly influential in my life as a moviegoer, but I am not willing to put it up on anything.
Leonardo DiCaprio from Titanic is on your Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, like Titanic feels
like
a
different Mount Rushmore.
It does feel different. Like, it's so big that it's kind of its different. Oh, it's like a the Christ the Redeemer just looms over everything else.
Right, right. Were you like somebody who watched Jurassic Park and was like, how do they make movies?
It was Titanic. Got it. Also, Ripley, like, it's like a Mount Rushmore of just like, when everything works well, this is what Hollywood movies can be. Like, this is like beautiful actors, beautiful craft, well, good direction, good script. Like, everything just clicks together.
All right, all right.
It'd be tough to fit Ripley, that on a plaque in front of Mount Rushmore.
But. Ripley, Shakespeare in Love, Sliding Doors. Is this a Paltrow Rushmore?
No.
Okay. I've blown up the podcast way too much. We'll come back next week. Feel free to send us your suggestions. Send them to Katie. She's going to chisel the Mount Rushmore. This was our actual talk about Ripley on Netflix, which a lot of you endorse, and maybe I will have to pick back up and stick with a little further, because it sounds like there's things to gain in 5, 6, 7, 8 or whatever in the back half.
I'm glad you brought this up, Patches, so in the future when listeners see the title Four Rushmores, they know we're not talking about four
the movie,
times
Rushmore.
Watch Rushmore, but we're each going to make a Rushmore. I love
is
that.
Rushmore also 99 or is that 98? 98. Okay. Yeah, stay tuned for when Dave watches the movie The Talented Mr. Ripley. And
we have a lot of homework here.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my, do I like men?
I mean, if you don't like Jude Law in The Talented Mr. Ripley, like, I just don't think you're a human being. Like, I think their sexual orientation has nothing to do with it.
Fair.
All that I have is a river. The river is always my home. Lord, take me away, for I just cannot stay. I'll sink in my skin and my bones. The water sustains me.
All right, for our mini segment, we're talking about the biggest thing that everyone watched in the last week. It's called The Solar Eclipse of April 8th, 2024.
It did happen.
I don't have the total stats here. I know we had an eclipse in 2017.
We did.
And that this is not a terribly uncommon thing that happens. I think the surprising thing is that there was a huge stretch of total darkness area. Like, if you were in the right place of America at the right time, you could see totality. You could see full 100% coverage of the sun. Now, people were talking about this for more than a year. I'm sure you guys have friends who went somewhere in the kind of dark zone.
We all do. Our friend Jordan Hoffman, friend to us all.
Okay. Former guest, future guest. Jordan went. He went there. He went to Buffalo, New York, I believe, based on just intense texting. Like, I was getting the play-by-play of him screaming "sun" at the sky whenever the clouds would part, because it was actually a very cloudy time in the Northeast. And if you were in Buffalo, you may have whiffed it, and you should have settled for 90% here in New York and New Jersey.
In Burlington, Vermont, they had totality and had beautiful, clear skies. So not all of the Northeast.
Here's my question. Why didn't any of us give enough of a shit to get ourselves to a good position to see what could be, and it's supposedly the last like full totality eclipse that we can witness here in America until like the 2070s?
2044 is when there's the next one, but it's going to be mostly
that one's
in like
totality in Colorado.
You know what? 2070 something is actually the next one that if you're in New York City, you could actually, you just stay here and look up.
Yeah.
I
didn't travel because I traveled in 2017, baby. I went to South Carolina. South Carolina. It went right over the lake where my parents have a house. It was easy. But, you know, I took the day off of work and did it. And it was one of the most mind-blowing things I'd ever seen.
Really?
And
why?
Because the sun went dark. I don't know. Like, the pictures don't really do a good job of capturing it. But
I don't know. They have some pretty damn good pictures. I mean, now. Pictures I would Google around and find pictures of from space of looking at Earth and getting the like Lovecraftian shadow from the ether creeping over
that's
the globe.
Actually cool.
It's really I found that. I found some pictures that I did not expect to think were like really terrifying.
Okay, so
like darkness encompassing.
I don't know what your experience was like in New Jersey. And actually, Dave, I have no clue how close anything got to you. I did not get any of your story of it. But like even here where we had like 90% or 87% or whatever, like the sun got hazier. It cooled down. Like weird breezes started coming up and you kind of sense something way, way bigger than you are coming for you. And when you're in the path of totality, it gets darker, it gets windier, like the sunset starts all around you, and you can take your dang glasses off and look at the sun with a ring around it. It's surreal and supernatural.
What's wrong with people?
No, you're supposed to, like, you're allowed to at the actual totality, you're allowed to take it off, and then the minute it comes back, you have to. That's the only way you're gonna see like the proper like corona around it. I mean, we like saw it from a boat. So we were in the middle of a lake and we could like see all around us as like the sunset colors kind of stopped up and not watch the birds like fly back to their roosts and stuff like that. There's just, you know, there's not that many things that are that much bigger than you and aren't there all the time. It's not like Niagara Falls, which you can like, you know, if you miss it today, it'll be there tomorrow. Like you have to be right there. It is hard to describe. It is a really unique thing. And my brother saw the totality in Vermont. And so the same thing. It was just like it kind of defies all the expectations you could have
That's
for it.
Kind of what I wanted to really talk about or put a finger on for our mini, which is I'm big in. I like space. I like thinking way too big of ideas and making my head spin, thinking about the universe and its endlessness. I love space. Could not bring myself to give a shit about the solar eclipse. And I don't know why. Maybe it's my place in life and everything I have to deal with, but I there's something about this that does not feel very momentous to me. And I'm trying to connect with people who really care and think it is like this glorious heavenly moment.
Does it bum you out that you don't care about it? Like, do you feel disappointed in yourself?
I guess it does a little bit. Like, I feel like I should care more and I don't know why. But the rest of you seem like
I'm airdropping into this.
Yeah, you don't give a shit.
I'm airdropping into this midway because I had to put my son back to bed, and hopefully the sound of my voice won't bring him back out of his bed. But
the son back to bed.
The son. Yeah, no, I kind of feel the way that Patches did. I respect the fact that being in the path of totality would be a very different experience. And obviously nothing could compare with the previous eclipse, which I watched on Jason Sudeikis' lawn when he was when he lived down the street from me.
Wow, things were so much, they had such a bright future ahead of them back
Lasso.
Then. Yeah.
This was pre his divorce from Olivia Wilde. This is before she made, Don't Worry, Darling. It was a more innocent time. I think this may have been the moment that actually corrupted them both and sent them on their respective paths.
They looked into an eclipse and they could never look at each other.
Like the heroes from heroes before them, their lives were forever changed.
I was on a run with my eclipse glasses. I was like literally just going on a run, but I brought my eclipse glasses with me and I stopped. I saw him on his lawn and I was like, well, this is as good a place as any for me to watch the eclipse, I guess. And he was like, hey, can I borrow those? And I was like, sir, I'm sweating all over these like crazy. And he was like, I don't care. And so we had a nice little moment. Anyway, obviously this eclipse did not compete, even though I was also on my way to the gym when it happened, but being in
you really didn't care. You were not at home, like waiting.
I know.
For
I specifically went to the gym during the eclipse because I knew that the treadmills would be open, and I was right.
That is depressing.
But it was depressing. I mean, it's like, should I care more about this? I guess I looked up at them with the glasses. I had a pair of the glasses. Look cool.
You know what?
I think being
the truth
be different. But I think that like people, what depressed me about it, Patches, is that I think what a lot of people respond to, is just participating in this moment of sort of like cosmic recognition and like seeing where we are in the universe. And then there's a social media component to it where it's like, we're all doing this together. And the fact that I didn't care about any of that, I found personally, I texted my wife and I was like, am I a bad person for this?
Here's
and she was like, no, she was in her office.
I think this is my theory. And it touches on what you're saying, which is like, it's a collective moment where you get to go out and a lot of people sit in a lawn together and look up at the sun because they've been told this is going to be important, but they've actually been driven to do something with their community. And And nothing ever feels big enough to do that. But like, as people who go to the movies a lot, and for you going to like film festivals and being part of the first group to witness this thing, I bet you feel this in like a micro way a lot more than other people, and that we've lost community and community viewing of things. And as a movie, regular moviegoer, you feel it in such micro ways that this momentous occasion that's supposed to bring everyone together.
I don't know just about like, that. I wonder like if maybe you've just hit the nail on the head as to why I feel so disinclined to go out and do these things socially on a more regular basis and like be in arenas and shit like that. And like go to concerts and all these things. Well, like maybe because I'm like getting that serotonin boost from my job, like seeing challengers in a basement of 68th Street, I guess is the high that you're talking about. I don't know.
What's going to be more momentous? The eclipse or challengers?
Honestly challengers is what I will remember about yesterday. And
don't
I definitely spent like 3 minutes in the Uber ride home trying to make some sort of joke about Mike Feist, Zendaya, and Josh O'Connor being my path of totality, and then abandoned it. But that movie rules, and the eclipse
was fine. We'll get there.
And I guess, you know, it's the difference between seeing challengers on your phone, which was like me looking at the eclipse on my way to the gym, and seeing it in IMAX, 68th Street. You know, so
I have very a weird experience. Because this, in terms of where I was in the path of the eclipse, was very similar to the 2017 eclipse, which Java and I both got glasses for. We went outside. Our entire building was there because it's on basically the other side of the building from where our windows are. So we were all out. We were all watching it. Then the pandemic happened, and I spent like most of a year howling like a wolf at 7 p.m. along with most of Denver just to tell everybody else that we were out there for each other. And now for 2024, since I wasn't in the path of totality, I watched the Disney Plus live stream of people who were in the path of totality and being like, look at those people having fun with their community. I don't
Disney
need to do that.
Plus stream? Was it National Geographic plugin or something?
Yes. I watched the ABC News broadcast. Maybe it was a similar
thing. I mean, that
might
have been the same thing. I watched Al Roker be, you know, stunned at the totality of the eclipse. And then I clicked right over to a new episode of Bluey, and it was fun.
Oh, Ghost Basket's really good, but
the end shot of Ghost Basket.
Do you think the show's ending? Do you think Bluey's over?
Maybe we talk about that next week after the sign comes out.
I'll watch the special.
But yeah, I in terms of like these big community event things, it was just so similar to the 2017 one. I'm like, kind of been there, done that. Had a gigantic cultural traumatic experience in between the two things. Who gives a shit about the moon moving in front of the sun when we all live through a pandemic together?
I'm
not on the three body problem. You know,
I mean, I love seeing pictures of my friends' kids watching, you know, their first eclipse that they got to like actually see. But I've seen that shit before. This isn't a once in a lifetime experience for me.
I mean, I felt the same way, which is why I didn't travel for it. But I think going through the pandemic since the last eclipse is a lot of exactly like you're out there howling. We learn the ways that we are and aren't there for each other, and the idea of something that can unite everybody in wonder as opposed to what we were doing this time 4 years ago. We reunited in terror and uncertainty. It's worth celebrating.
I also think, I mean, I'm certainly not arguing with that. I do not want to disabuse anyone of their own personally held notion that the eclipse is a meaningful thing to go and see.
That's not what this is.
But part of me is also just like, I am frequently thinking about our place in the universe and smallness, and this sort of ties into my agnosticism and existential crises. And, I didn't really feel like there was much in the way of revelation in seeing this. It's like, yeah, I get it. I know where we are relative to the sun and where the sun is relative to the rest of the cosmos as best as any of us can. And I think about this all the time.
I should use this firsthand
evidence of it in a more acute way than usual. I don't think it's going to do much for me, but I do think the sort of environmental phenomenon of being in totality, what Katie was talking about things are quieter and how dramatically the light shifts as opposed to it just looking like it has an Instagram filter on it like it did in Brooklyn, would be a different experience. I'm just not willing to travel to do it. Maybe in 2079, whatever the fuck, if I'm still alive. And when I'm, they'll drag my,
wheel you out.
My corpse on my, yeah. my body that's plugged up into something. And we'll go.
To wrap up, I should say that I also have this, in recent years, I've had this recurring dream where, like, man gets to moon and we start drilling into it and it cracks and I'm, like, watching the moon break up in the Earth's atmosphere and everything goes to hell. And if anyone else has that recurring dream, I'm here for you. And I understand why,
well, being on the Challenger?
Why you don't want to look at the moon. No. What?
What? That's all. I just like half tuned out and then heard about you talking
you're
about
you're
being
just thinking about challengers
up.
And hearing me think about things breaking up in the atmosphere.
Maybe challengers can reclaim the word.
I'm opening my heart to you about
from
my apocalyptic dreams and you're just half listening. Well, this has been Eclipse Talk.
I'm glad I was not on the Challenger.
Yeah, me too.
Get control, you son. They don't owe you, they own you, son. They control you, son. Maybe bones, they gon' throw you some. But you get bold and they gon' bone you, son. You tryna blow you, son. That's the reason why you blow you, son. Try to take back what they stole you, son. Don't join the show, you son. Don't you see they tryna hold you, son?
Last week in Durham, North Carolina, here where I live, was the return of the Full Frame Documentary Festival, which had been off for a few years. It went all virtual during the pandemic. This is the first in-person one they'd done since 2019, which is crazy. It is a pretty major documentary festival. They get a lot of the best titles from Sundance and a lot of independent work and new films. There were films like Look Into My Eyes that was at Sundance that was there. Daughters,
good
which
movie.
Two really good movies. Daughters, which won the I think the Audience Award for Documentary at Sundance. And then also Girl State, which premiered on Apple TV Plus the day after it premiered at Full Frame. But still, anytime you get to see, like, I went to a Full Frame screening of the Agnes Varda movie from 1980 called Murmurs, about murals in Los Angeles. And it was 10 a.m. on a Thursday morning and the audience was like pretty full. And I was like, yes. This is the only kind of thing you get at a film festival where everyone's really devoted. So yeah, watch a movie in a theater full of people instead of just on Apple TV Plus. But if you watch Girls Stand on Apple TV Plus, where it is right now, I think you will find a lot to enjoy and get out of it. It is more or less a sequel to the 2020 film Boys State, which I really loved, by the same directors, whose names I should have pulled
Jesse Moss
up.
And Amanda McBain.
Thank you.
They did The Missing last year. Geo, right?
Was
which you also like.
Yeah, that was a really good movie. I forgot
the
that
mission.
Was them.
Sorry, The Mission.
So yeah, so Boys State and Girls State are events put on by the American Legion in all 50 states except Hawaii.
Anyone ever do it? Can we just quick pause?
I went to Nerd Camp, but I never heard of this.
I didn't even hear about it.
No,
every state has it. Every single state has this.
I know.
And I never even heard of it.
Is this something you wish you had had the chance to do?
Honestly, yes.
I think you would have
watched this movie and I was like, fuck, I messed up. I went the wrong direction.
Yeah.
What's wrong with me?
Did you also see Boys State or did you see the girls where you're just like, why can't I be included in this?
Well, Girls State looked more fun.
Girl State does look more fun.
Girl State has less of the like future tech cruises, which is what a lot of.
I don't
want
to be in like the faux military. Boys. So maybe there's a reason I didn't go to Pennsylvania Boys State.
Well, what was so endearing about Boys State is the faux military aspect, I guess, is right. But it is like people who are like the future young Republicans trying to make their name for it. And then the kids who are just like, no, I just really want to argue about like the merits of like trade law. And they get up there and they get so into it. And
the girls in Girl State have significantly bigger fish to fry, especially given when the movie was made.
Yeah. So the movie is made in the summer of 2022. So the leaked Dobbs opinion comes out while they're there. And about a week later, the Supreme Court officially overturns Roe v. Wade. So as if that wasn't going to be high on their list of topics, it becomes that way. And at some point during the film, so these girls gather, they're there to form a fake, a mock government. They're running for governor in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court hears a case. I guess the legislature meets in Girl State. You see a lot of that in Boy State and like very little of it in this one. But something that they point out is that the way that Girl State is structured kind of is less incentivizing them to talk about major issues. It's a lot more about social capital and running your governor campaign by having your friends campaign for you. And something that the movie Boy State never did, which is cut to what the concurrent Boys State is doing. It's in Missouri, it's on the same campus. And so you see the girls in Girl State kind of you know, figuring out social dynamics, whereas the boys are like, Mr. Speaker, I object on rule, blah, 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 whatever. Like, you see the boys state is structured so that they take on weightier issues faster. And one of many things that's interesting about girl state is how they push against that. They push against the kind of smaller injustices about dress codes that are facing them and all of the Roe v. Wade stuff in really interesting ways and in really unresolved ways. It doesn't feel like they've solved anything by the end of this, but you kind of see the gears turning in their head. It's such a fascinating note to end in the film on. There's a lot of arcs and narratives in there, but you know that the work is unfinished, which is not how Boy State ended at all as well. I really liked it.
I really liked this too. And I had heard whispers that that's like, this one's not, doesn't hit as hard. And why did they kind of do this? They had to have a companion film or something. But I thought all the characters they found, and I find the process of making a documentary like this fascinating, where I have to imagine you go to Girl State, you just start filming and you try and do the research. You try to meet people who are going to be perfect characters for you. And they really found some fascinating high schoolers to follow for this. Very charismatic. But
you've also got to convince their parents to let you do it. I really wonder how they pull that off.
So here's something I think about during every documentary.
I imagine their parents would be pretty hyped for kids to want to be like the leaders of tomorrow.
Personal question for all of you. Would you be able to act normal on a camera if a documentary crew was following you? Do you think you'd be able to just like,
if I were 15,
there?
Yes. If I were 39, no.
Ooh, I kind of feel the opposite. Like, I think at 15, I'd be much more.
If the internet existed, probably not. If it didn't.
I mean, we talk into a microphone every week and eventually act like our dumb selves. So maybe that's example.
Yeah, but nobody listens to that show, and I think that's part of its charm. that's really what makes it possible.
What do you think, Patches? Would you be normal?
I don't even know. It feels like I want to be tested on some level. Like, I want this. I guess I want a camera to follow me around for a week just to understand if I would be debilitated by it, I guess, or enhanced, or if I'd be like on or too on. I don't know. I don't know myself well enough. I want this test. Make a documentary about me.
Yeah, make a documentary about Matt Patches.
What could go wrong?
Do you think that the girls in Girl State act like their authentic selves, or are they performing?
Yes, I think so. And I'd be curious what you all think about that, because I do feel like I'm really embedded in the moment and I'm getting kind of raw teen energy. I'll say this. I was gnashing my teeth a lot during this movie, like having trouble listening to them talk awkwardly and give speeches but maybe not be good at public speaking, and I was just like, oh my god, teen life is so awkward. And when they are navigating, and so in Girl State, in this documentary, they're being combined for the first time, so the boys are around on campus and they have to interact with them, and like, it all feels by force. I was curious if you guys thought that the editing around integrating the boys state stuff, or like seeing the boys, if that felt like it had an extra touch to make commentary about being around the boys, like if it felt cinematic in that way, or if it felt just 100% authentic, truthful, and these guys just seemed like pigs. But god, I thought the film did a really good job of putting you in the shoes of these young women and making you feel like icky around the boys, because the boys are so pig-headed and awful just naturally. Like when they walk by on campus, they're all flexing and being assholes. Great line by one of them. One of the girls just looks over and says, "They're little sheep, bah." Mm-hmm. I just thought that was
that girl.
Big can't hardly wait. Big can't hardly wait vibes. You're just sheep.
It was amazing. And but yeah, I couldn't tell if like the filmmakers were putting their finger on the scale a little bit to make us feel that friction, which I don't think is necessarily wrong. It's ecstatic truth, perhaps. But I found that really interesting in the dynamics at play, and then trying to navigate it. Like the girls within the girls, and like some people who are really issue oriented being outdone by the really vocal, over the top, like feminism driven women, which I found fascinating. So there's a lot of friction that they discovered along the way. And I was just so taken by the characters. This one young woman, Tochi, I think, who's the daughter of a Nigerian parents. And, you know, she knows it's like such a complicated worldview that I think. So life on social media flattens, where she's like worried about putting herself out there, and she knows she's going to encounter microaggressions from all these white Missouri women, and she does like almost immediately, but then also is like totally understood, and they work through that, and then she like finds herself very much embraced over the course of her stay at Girl State. I just thought there's a lot of layers at play, and the documentary does a good job of like peeling them back in a very watchable way.
Do you think she intentionally botches the attorney general side of the abortion debate because she needs to be popular?
To be popular? Ooh.
Or just to be liked?
I don't know.
She literally starts her argument with like the dictionary defines privacy by, and I'm like,
yeah, that's pretty
you
bad.
Gotta,
that's
you gotta,
probably
but
something
she also
I
says she doesn't
want to
win because of her belief, her political beliefs. That's, so I don't know if it's just
sort of that blonde girl whose entire political career rests upon her trying to hide her political beliefs from her would-be constituents.
Yeah,
always bringing it up, and like her arc is so interesting to me because she ends and she's like, "I love journalism."
Is this
and
Emily,
like, cool.
the conservative one?
Who becomes a reporter?
And I'm like, cool. I'm glad you become a reporter. Learn why there's a comma in the Second Amendment, then come back and talk to me about reporting on things. This movie
a conservative young person wanting to go into journalism was a positive, and I saw that as a win.
This movie's
society.
A great documentary because it made me realize we're doomed.
Oh,
if we're doing it, we're doomed for the exact reason that like what Patches said, where it's like the people who end up winning these things are the showmen. They're the Donald Trumps of this political theater.
Mm-hmm.
It is not an issue based thing. There's a very nice girl who wants to be on the Supreme Court, but ultimately becomes an appellate judge who is actually talking about issues. And she is beat by a white girl who in her like Supreme Court interview is like, I think I'd be a good Supreme Court judge because like I'd have a conversation with a wall if I could. And I'm like, what the fuck does that mean?
Yeah.
What are we promoting here? And then luckily the documentary continues to go to this issue after Emily, you know, loses as governor to become a journalist. And she ends up, you know, drilling down on the inequalities between Girls State and Boys State. And they're like, great job pointing out the inequalities. We're going to change your headline and give you a scholarship, so you please shut up about it. And that's the end of the movie. Like, one of the last interviews of the movie is the woman who does run governor being like, yeah, I don't think this isn't prepping us to do government. This is prepping us to accept their sexism in the process and be prepared for it, not actually fight sexism. And I'm like, what a fantastic film to show that this is all bullshit. The American Legion is going to destroy us if this is what we're prepping our future politicians
This is the most Dave take imaginable on this,
that's
by the way.
I think it's a good documentary because of that, because I'm engaged with all the stories. I don't hate these girls for having aspirations. The process breaks them because they're shunted
into a
process.
Here's the thing. I think what's interesting about the movie is that you say that the process breaks them, but I think they all know how to operate within the process. So something before Girls State and Boys State has already broken these kids, and it's their way into politics. One person, I think it was even Emily, was like, it was the girl who maybe becomes governor or something. Well, one of them is like, I used to just down right wing.
Yeah, it's the girl who becomes governor. It's a different girl. It's Faith.
I used to be called alt-right. Mm-hmm. Oh, right. And Faith is the pretty reasonable issue based on that.
She's the one who says the sheep
her
line.
Her family was like MAGA-pilled, and so she escaped that, thankfully. So
and she brings up like gun legislation in her speech, but she does it so soberly, she loses to the yelling feminism girl. No.
But here's what I thought was startling and indicative of like, this is all happening before people arrive to Girl State. Everyone who runs for Supreme Court, they have to do interviews. They're interviewed by maybe the previous court or whatever. Like, they're doing interviews to get these seats. I found that segment really interesting because all of these girls are coming to the table. And I don't remember too much of this from the Boys State, Katie, if you have a clear memory of like how much Supreme Court is on that. But they all come to the interviews talking about their political direction. And they'd be like, if I sit on the court, I want to rule in favor of environmental issues. Or if I sit on the court, I want to cast judgment on this and impart my values on it. I found that very kind of disturbing in a Dave way where I'm like, oh, this is already broken. Like, all of these people should be coming in and say, I'm totally impartial. And what I stand for is the judgment of law and interpretation of law. You don't see anyone doing that. You now see a lot of kids convinced that you have to You don't want to be president anymore. You want to be on the Supreme Court. You want to, if you want to decide things in life, you need to infiltrate the Supreme Court and make it agenda driven. Now, well, that is how reality works. I understand. But to be on that page when you're so young, I find fascinating.
I think that's the hand of the documentary a little bit, because having seen Boys State not focus on that and then knowing what's going on in the background of Girls State, I think it's really important that they show that part of the process. But like overall, like the impression that I got from Girls State is there are positions and there are popularity contests to get in the positions. Once you're in the position, nobody gives a fuck what you do, really. So it's like they are coming in, they're saying like, I want to represent this, but they're saying that to a very small group of people that are all from the same state that all have very similar backgrounds. They've all won something at their school. They're all like leaders in their school, which I appreciate, but those things don't necessarily, those things shouldn't necessarily lead to politics. They should lead to like activism. So like both Boys State and Girls State, I think the most interesting part of them as documentaries is watching the people who probably should be activists, or in the case of Emily, when she's like, I want to be president, a journalist, or a rock star. I'm like, I want to see the documentary where Emily goes to rock camp for a week and like learns like that sort of shit. Like, I want her to be happy, and that's going to make her happy out of the three careers that she wants. But like both of these movies, I think, are great documentaries because you watch the people that at the beginning of the movie, you're like, I like their ideas, I like their shine. You just watch them get flattened and disillusioned into popularity contests, into arguing, like, in the case of Boys State, like, weird sub-statutes and trying to, like, outmaneuver somebody. Or here in Girls State, just trying to make a coalition of similar girls without ever talking shit about anybody. The girls are so nice when it's, like, the part of what we would like with politicians, at least between Girls State and Boys State, I think it would be nice to have a little bit of the Boys State, you know, trying to claws fuck each other in like actual policy reflected in Girls State. And maybe that was just something they didn't get into in this documentary because of the time that it was filmed. But yeah, I found both of these documentaries in tandem kind of depressing. Girls State, I was happy because I think a lot more of the girls came to a similar conclusion of me, which is like, this process is kind of fucked. So it was great to see that reflected in this documentary, where it's like the Boys State one, the people who I saw get disillusioned, where I was like, oh, you were the person I actually would like to have in politics. And they kind of get disillusioned because they kind of get shoved out of, like, by the, I don't know, the dude mentality of it all.
Don't you feel like the girls would get disillusioned and this kind of are digging in their heels and trying to do more with it? Like, I guess specifically thinking of what's her name, the journalist girl,
Emily.
What's her name? Patches, you mean Emily? Just, Emily. Like, she, like, her article does get like the teeth taken out of it, but it feels like that motivates her even more to like try to fight up against a system that's not working for her. Like, I felt more hope for the people who maybe not want to go into politics, but like this kind of up close glimpse of how much the deck is stacked against them didn't get teach them to give up on it. It taught them to like find different ways into it. I found that very hopeful.
I would love for that to be a case. Again, she needs to read the Second Amendment.
She does. I mean, she, you know, putting all my hopes on a girl who is like a conservative Missourian is not necessarily the way to do it. But I think there's a lot of people, like, even the, you know, the girl who like wins for governor basically as a popularity thing. Like, she seems to have good ideas and I think knows it was a popularity thing. So how do you use that like energy she builds around her to bring good ideas to stuff? She can do that.
I feel great about the characters and I hope the girls are okay. I'm just saying, both of these movies taken as one, we're like absolutely fucked because we're enforcing a system upon people. We're like, you're going to have the governors, you're going to have the House, you're going to have the Supreme Court, just like we've like figured it all out. I would love to see young people actually put together a government that tries to function with all of them. That would be interesting. But like every once in a while, we cut to the Boys State that is being sworn in by the actual governor and having speakers being like, pro-life is saving lives, and this is why, and it's like,
there's
even the girls are like,
ideas.
Even the girls are like, what the fuck is this? And then you, like, you know, they have an entire band, and the Girls State one is like, you know, this is very nice, smiling woman in, like, her late 40s, early 50s, and the other one is like a fucking 65-year-old dude wearing, like, his Navy hat. Like, really what I got out of this is like, bless the children, fuck the American Legion. This is a practice that is just as weird as like fucking Boy Scout camp or Bible camp, both of which I attended as a child and both of which I went away with. Like, this is brainwashing. They're brainwashing me. I kind of wish this would go away. But great documentaries.
Yeah.
Katie, will you send your children to a Boy State?
Sure. I mean, if that was something you wanted to do, yeah, of course. Like this, like the idea of like you spend part of your summer like getting together with a bunch of kids and trying to like build government again. Like, you know, one of these times maybe they're gonna fix it. Like, you know, a kid doing like Model UN or debate team or something like that would be great. I didn't have stuff like that, but I would have. Yeah. I would ruled at it had I had access to it.
I do want to plug, I saw a film in 2022, it's called Girl Talk. It's by a director named Lucia Small, who unfortunately passed away while she was filming it. But one of the producers I work with stepped in to sort of help finish it. It is about five teenage girls on debate team that are trying to be, you know, number one in the U.S. and sort of the difference between girls debate and boys debate, and it's a very similar in terms of like a girl state sort of like attitude, but I think they come away with a couple more W's in the overall things that they learn about the structure. All great documentaries, I think, if you want to hope that the kids are all right, or maybe spotlight how maybe we're failing the children by shunting them into things that maybe we would have liked to do.
Katie just said she would send her sons there, and you think it's failing the children. Dave, here's a question. What do you think is more harmful for high schoolers? Boys state, girls state, or high school football?
Oh, high school football.
Okay. I'm just glad we're still in the same
side.
We
can agree on that.
Oh, no. And like the reason I probably wouldn't have done like a boys state in Colorado or something is because, you know, when that was happening, George W. Bush was president, I would have not wanted to do it. You know, I would have, even if I did go to Boy State because I was like an overachiever, I would definitely not win anything because
you
I'd
wouldn't
be yelling
go
at people
because
all
you
the
would
time.
Have been participating at the RNC convention in New York. You were too busy to.
I love the idea of teenage Dave going to Boy State just yelling at everybody the entire time. You would have won some converts,
that would
I'm
be
sure.
That's a documentary I would happily, happily watch.
What if I went to Boy State like next year? Like, what if I'm the only grown-ass man and I'm being screamed at by children?
They would probably own your ass, honestly. Like, you're not ready for those kids.
I would love to be screamed at by children about politics. I think that's much more interesting than being screamed at by my peers about politics.
Yeah, shouldn't you be encouraged that any kid cares about politics, Dave? Isn't this a positive for people at least being aware of the need for these issues?
I wish they came out of either of these documentaries being more interested in politics, like the ones that I really appreciated their journey. Like Emily, like again, the fact that she comes out as a journalist, she comes out as more curious and she's able to spotlight the inequality is great. It makes me overcome the things I didn't like about her when she was introducing herself. That's real politics. And that's what I would like to see more of. It's just unfortunate that when she does it, she basically takes down the institution that is the subject of the movie in order to like do that, you know, fully. So like I applaud that. I just think if this is like the status quo, it makes me feel like we're doomed.
Well, on that note, Girl State on Apple TV Plus.
That does it for this week's show. We'll be back next week. We'll talk about something. We're figuring it out. In the meantime, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Patches, executive editor at Polygon. I'm on Blue Sky and Letterboxd. And we have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can go back to listen to old episodes of the show. I'm trying to imagine anything. I don't think we did a Boy State podcast. So this is both. I don't know. I don't remember. Well, there's only one way to find out. Yep. Fightinginthewarroom.com.
My name's David Ehrlich. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich and on Letterboxd David Ehrlich and Instagram at David Ehrlich and all that shit. You can find me on IndieWire writing about Challengers. The embargo for that is this Friday. That's a movie. It's a movie. What a film. You can find all of us together on Fighting in the War Room on the Apple Podcasts app. Leave us a review. We'll read it live on the show. If you neglect to do that, I will have no choice but to tell you about how I'm currently one of the top 5,000 ranked Marvel Snap players on God's Green Earth.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I don't want to have to do that. You don't want me to have to do that. It's no one wants that. So either I have to start losing precipitously, which usually happens around this time every season, or you need to leave us a review on Fighting in the War Room at the Apple Podcast app, or you could email us. Where could they do that?
You can email us at fitwr.podcast@gmail.com. I'm Dave Gonzalez. Spell my first name, D-A-7-E, which is my handle on Letterboxd, Twitter, and Blue Sky. Got my girlfriend into Marvel Snap because I was in the hospital for a couple of days. If you want to check out what we said about Boy State, that is on episode 313, where we checked it out for a pandemic check-in. It also made Katie's top 10s of 2020, if you want to listen to that episode. But definitely send us some emails. We've been enjoying it. We love you guys. That's it for me.
Indeed. I'm Katie Rich. I'm on this podcast. I'm on social media in various places at Katie Rich, on Instagram at Katie Rich Talking. I put Girl State on Letterboxd. And every time I'm watching TV, I'm just like, damn, I can't put it on Letterboxd and prove to people that I'm watching things. So that's where my brain is at. You can find us all on Twitter and Blue Sky at FITWR, where you can tell us what you would yell about if you were to go to Boys or Girls State right now, or you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was:
in honor of Alex Garland's Civil War, out this weekend, where California and Texas have allied as the Western forces, declare your state for or against them.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back talking to you next week.
Anything for me.
I'm done.